Session number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, Reel 6.
Mr. George S. Richardson, Reel 6. Whilst it had come, the role of the battalion had changed. It was no longer static defence. What was the role of the battalion at Ufcombe and Devon?
Yes, we often wondered that ourselves. We were doing long route marches. We were doing massive exercises up on the moors, Exmoor. We went all around, right across from one side of Devon to the other, up and down, north and south. Up on the high hills in Devon, there was one big exercise. I remember that was in January, round about the anniversary of me entering, and we had a two brigade exercise. We were in attack. The 151 Durham Brigade were in attack, and the 149 Brigade, the East Yorks and Green Howards, were in defence. They were dug in up on the moor, and we had to manoeuvre our transport and advance on their positions, and they had to find out how close we could get before they really located us. We had a rough idea where they were, they had a rough idea where we were. The snow came down, the transport, being our Royal Army Service Corps, took us up there. It had left us, and we were more or less up on foot. We were advancing on foot. They were dug in. It was freezing cold. We only had one blanket that we had to carry with our greatcoats and our great pack. We were up there for 3 days. At the end of the 3 days, our transport had to struggle to get through to us, to take us off. Most of us had... the ground was too hard to dig latrines, and we just had to use any old hedge back and shortage of the usual toilet facilities, and most of us got cold. After the 3 days, our transport did get through and brought us back to Ofcom. As soon as we got back to Ofcom, they gave us 24 hours rest. After that, we found out through the signals that the brigade in defence was still up on the moors, and we also found that Lysanders had been used to drop supplies because we were in a very bad position, we were in a very bad condition, and I think they lost two or three through the bitter weather.
Were you still a motorised division?
We'd only motorised as far as the Royal Army Service Corps belonged to the division. Used to come and take us on away from our Ofcombe base up onto the moors, then leave us. And when we were left, we were just infantry. But we were motorised division when we had to travel far.
How did the people of Ofcombe receive you?
Oh, I think going on pretty well with them. They used to like to say is marching through Ofcombe. We did a Sunday morning parade to church in Ofcombe. We always filled the church in Ofcombe. Our bugle band really got down to practice in Ofcombe. The bugle just be marching up and down the lanes outside of Ofcombe, actually. They're making that much racket sometimes. They would have to get used because our buglers sounded off at... Rivali Retreat, Tattoo, Officers Mess Call, and all the battalion calls that you normally receive when you're in barracks, and they were just sounded. And of course, all the companies around in different billets, and the officers heard the different calls and they rallied. When it was falling A, falling B, we knew the companies had to fall in on the square.
Did you get any opportunity for leisure and sport?
At that time, there was one or two small concerts arranged, but no big concert parties in Ofcom. We never saw any real big Interstars there. Our Baffin facilities in Ofcom was a big brewery. The big vats that they'd used, it was a Finnish brewery, and the big vats used to be loaded up with water, I think around about 5 foot deep, really hot water sometimes, and we just used to be splashing around in that for about, you know, about 50 or 60 at a time. Whole platoons of us just going there certain times of the day, maybe once a week for a bath. And I think most of the battalions use that facility for bathing. So we kept fairly clean. But leisure, there wasn't much leisure. There's no cinema anywhere near. We weren't allowed to go into any other places. In Ofcom itself, there were, two pubs. Those were always full. There was another pub up on the Willand Road that us as signalers has already got to know, and we used that. Our officer had got Mr. Hollis had got very friendly with a lady that her mother run the Willand Cafe, and it was a posh little place on the Exeter Road, and we knew that there were odd times he'd disappear, and we knew where he was. He always used to say, if you want me, just send somebody up the Willand Cafe.
Did the people take the men into their homes?
No, not maybe the odd one. Not no, I think wartime facilities, I mean, quite a lot of the men had gone. There were very few young girls around. There were very few young peasants around. There was certainly nobody to go running after courting. Not around there, not much. I think our sergeant had a funny saying about this. He was not our Sergeant Scott was our sergeant, but he's Land Sergeant Dawes. He's a regular soldier, and as soon as he arrived in any new billet, any new place, he always went out and found the ugliest woman in the village. Nobody else would have her, and he knew he was all right for bed and breakfast. So that was about. And he used to tell us that. He says, "Don't you worry, Sergeant Dawes will find one." And but no, for leisure we didn't do much. We were hard at it. And the thing is, the training that we were doing, the bayonet charges, up on the moors, firing, and wrapped up in cold weather, we wondered what we were training for.
Were you doing this kind of training?
Oh, yes.
Although you were a signaller?
Oh, yes. Although we were signallers, we went up, and we were with company headquarters, and whenever we stopped, we still stopped for the night. We had to run a line out to the companies. We formed into small detachments, you see. A lance corporal with two men would take two or three reels of cable out and run to the nearest companies to put them in contact for during the night, so that the company commanders could be in contact with the CO.
When you ran a cable out, you said, I think there was about a third of a mile.
A third of a mile in each reel, yes.
That was just laid on top of the ground?
That was laid on top of the ground. Normally, unless, of course, we had to cross the main road, and we'd already learned that in training, how to cross roads and rivers.
And how did you do that?
Well, to cross a road, we had to, if it was a hard road, then we had to go up the nearest telegraph pole and run one across from one side to the other and drop it down. If it was soft ground, then we'd just dig a furrow across with our entrenching tools and bury them. Of course, we'd learned to do all this at, in our signal training, how to lay lines across roads, rivers, and such like. And we just more or less carried out basic training out whenever we had to run lines out. And of course, if they ever got damaged, then we had to take a telephone out and find the broken ends, connect it up, and find out which end was from which end we were speaking to, and join them in. And sometimes, if a carrier had run across the line, then we had to join a couple of a few yards in to make a new connection. It was mostly double cable, but of course infantry signals were also used earth signals from the telephone and earth down the ground at each end, and that was only single line. We could carry a lot more wire by carrying single line what we could double line, but double line of course was the best signal at all times.
Did you get any interference coming in from other lines around civil lines or whatever?
No, not that we're aware of. Not in general, no. We were told once we got into enemy territory that we had to watch what we're doing, crossing over old enemy lines, especially if we had made an advance or even a retreat. We'd have to watch that we didn't mix our lines in with the enemy lines. There's a different kind of cable anyway. And that was all coloured, as was usually just a dirty little brown thing.
Picking up that point, were you ever at any time taught how to break into any of the lines and listen to conversation?
Oh, of course. This was called teeing in. We did this with a safety pin. A short lead from the telephone on each of the two terminals, with a safety pin at the end, and you didn't even have to break it open. You just stuck the safety pin through the centre core, cut through with the point into the line, close the safety pin so it wouldn't come off, and we would listen. And if there's any conversations going off, we could listen to find out whether English or German. I've never yet teed into a German call, but we used to do this if we were out on exercises, and we wanted to send a message back when we hadn't without breaking the line. We'd just tee in and send a message back to the signal office that we'd found such and such, and we would have to do something about it. So that was common. We were taught this, how to tee into lines by using a common garden safety pin. Mm. Usually a 2-inch safety pin.
Were you getting mail from home at this time?
Oh, yes. My mother was always writing at us. I think weekly, mostly weekly from my mother, she would ask how things were. But we were limited because all our mail was censored by our officer, Mr. Hulse. We had to hand him the letter. Anything that he blue penciled, well, whether it made sense or not, I don't know. But we never saw the letter once he got it. He just handed it on the post corporal, would collect it from the different section officers and transmit it through the army post.
Did the men resent this kind of thing?
I think we just knew that that had happened. It was a wartime precaution. That we were always tempted to say we're at such and such a place. Of course, when we're in England, we could more or less tell them where we were because our addresses were Ofcombe Devon. So our mail came direct to Ofcombe Devon through the army post. Once we were abroad, we were army field post, and we could only all our mail was, of course, strictly censored. While we were in Ofcombe doing all these strenuous exercises up on Dartmoor and Exmoor, there was rumours going around that our division was going to be transported to Iceland. Iceland was still in friendly hands, but they were expected to be invaded by the Germans at any time.
How did you view that prospect?
Well, we didn't like the idea of going to Iceland because we thought it would finish up with another Dunkirk because it was so cold and far away. And As far as I can remember, just the thought of going to Iceland wasn't very encouraging. Besides, it was too close to Germany. So, it never happened. But we found out later on that another division had also been doing exactly the same training, and they were the ones that went on to Iceland.
How long were you at UFCM?
Oh, 5 months, I think. Yes, 5 months. Oh, of course we were. Until May. And then...
Did you get a leave at Christmas?
That was my first leave home. After 10 months in the army, I had my first leave home just before Christmas. Then, after Christmas, we were doing more marching every week, exercises, until the spring came and conditions got a little bit better for exercise and general training. And then we were told to go and have lectures on what could happen in foreign parts, such as being bit by scorpions and things like that. By OMO, who showed us a lot of detail of what different diseases we could catch, including VV and all the rest of it. Sorry about that. And so we had an idea that something else was happening, and then supplies came in, and we were told to report to quartermaster stores, and we were issued with KD.
You must have realised you were going at least somewhere where it was hot.
Yes.
What were the rumours?
Well, the rumours were that we were going out to the Middle East. That's where the war was happening, in Libya. And we were told to dress up in our KD and get out on parade, so the people of UFCM knew that we were seated with KD also. The whole company, officers and everybody. I think the officers looked a bit more neater than we did because they bought their own shorts, but we could only wear what we were served with. We even had anti-mosquito cream in our packs and sterilising tablets that we could use for sterilising water. Our emergency ration had been checked, which was a stout bar of chocolate in our battle dress pocket that we carried with our field dressing in our battle dress pocket. They were all checked, and we were eventually given embarkation leave.
How did you feel yourself about going abroad?
I think more or less looking forward to it, somewhere I'd never been before, but I was always interested in getting on, but at the same time, I was a bit wary of what might happen to me. They gave us 14 days leave. We went home, and I told my mother that was embarkation leave, and we'd be going abroad soon. And
how did you take that?
Well, being the oldest son, I suppose she never showed a lot of anguish when I was around. She probably did when I was away, because she was a lovely little mother. And I suppose she did a lot of worrying that I never knew about.
On this leave, and knowing that you were going away and probably into a fighting situation, were you seeing young men of your own age who were not in the forces and who had protective jobs?
Yes, whenever I went into the local pub, of course I was in German Light Infantry uniform with the badges, and one or two would come up and ask how things were, those that knew me personally, and we can't grumble. Oh, yeah, look all right. It's a long time since you did any fighting and things like that, because nothing had been happening since Dunkirk, and they were more or less wanting to know when things were going to happen.
You didn't feel in any animosity towards the fact that you were going into danger and roughing it, and they was in a very cushy number, you might say.
Yes, well, I suppose I did up to a point, and I've just remembered that around about this time, a lot of the older men that had been in the Territorial Army before the war and were minors were sent out from both the companies and headquarters company. They were sent back home to be discharged onto reserve in the case, but they weren't going to be sent abroad. Now, I was going up to the signal officer, and I was going up to the signal office when the adjutant came down from headquarters in Ofcom, and threw my salute up, and he just passed me in, and he stopped, "Corporal, sir, I've just had papers through from a colliery to ask if you can be returned back to the mines. Apparently the mines were asking for men. They sent that many out that the country found it needed coal, and they were returning men who were." He said, so I said, "May I ask what which mine it was, sir?" He said, he wasn't a northerner himself. He said, "I think it was called New Harrington Quarry." I said, "Oh, that was my quarry." He says, "Well," he says, "because you're a signaller, trained, I'm afraid I've got to refuse going out of the army." And I just flung him a salute and said, "Well, all right, sir." I never made any more of it. If I'd really pushed and written to someone else, or even asked for to see the colonel, coming back to school, they probably would have said, "Well, okay, yes." Because, after all, I was being trained as an official in the quarry at the time. So that's why they requested me to go. So we had OKD issued, and we had our home leave, and the only thing that was left for us was to entrain, and the whole battalion entrained, and we were taken north. Not told where we were going. We stopped at, remember, at York Station.
Did you get a send-off from Ofcom? Did the people turn out for you?
I don't think they even knew. I don't think they were. I don't think we were allowed to tell them, and I don't think they even knew. And I think it was in the dark anyhow. But we were taken by Royal Army Service Corps vehicles to the station.
Do you recall the date?
Early May, 5th, I think. 5th of May, I think. I'm not sure. I don't know then.
1941,
yes. And we were stopped and given tea and sandwiches. They'd expected us at York. Then we went on and crossed over the country, and some people said, "Oh, that's Carlisle Station." And then we found ourselves at Glasgow. And people from the ex-Argyle Sun and Handlers that were with us were getting excited because we were going through Scotland. And we finished up at Gourock, where we entrained, where we got off the train and took all our equipment. Except for our haversacks that we carried, our own personal equipment, our kit bags had all been named with our army rank and number, and even had 6DLI on. The officers, their kit was not for use on board ship and all marked. We're taken over on barges, and we found ourselves on the Duchess of Richmond. The Drunken Duchess, it had a nickname, and we found out why later.
Why did it?
Well, apparently when the keel was laid down in Glasgow, and it was a Canadian Pacific liner, had been laid 4 foot out of line. And because the keel was 4 foot out of line, one side was just slightly more bowed than the other, and it rolled more than what it should have done. And it was called the Drunken Duchess for that purpose. It was around about 18,000 ton, I think. Very large ship. And we had all of the 6th Battalion and some of the brigade headquarters and 8th Battalion on the ship. And we sailed late at night. All our arms had been taken from us, locked up in the armory. We weren't allowed to wear our boots on the decks. We had to use our PT shoes for going around the decks. I was detailed for guard duties up on the off-top deck. And there were about a dozen of us with Bren guns set up on Bren gun stands. And they were there for the purpose of anti-aircraft fire. How many aircraft have ever been shot down by a Bren gun, I'll never know, but I don't fancy much chance of it ever happening. But it didn't happen while we were on board.
What was the accommodation like on the ship for you?
We had issued with hammocks. Hammocks and a couple of blankets. And I tried, not the first night because I was up on the deck. We had a guard room up on deck where we were given our suppers. And we sailed out during the night down the Clyde and out in the Atlantic. And it was more or less getting daylight when we go into the Atlantic. It was early morning, because it was...
Were you packed pretty tight?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The ship was just about as packed as many as what they could, because everybody was on board, all arms. And, of course, besides our ship, there was the Georgic, which sailed alongside on the opposite side of our large escort, which was the Exeter. We had one of the finest of the fighting ships at the time. It had already seen action, more than what we had at that time, except for those that had come from Dunkirk. It had been replaced. Anyway, it had a seaplane mounted on the rear, and it sailed out. And during the night, we were watching the ship just go up and down. Because I was on the aft deck, we could look over the front bows into the sea, and then when it rose up, we're looking more or less at the bows of the deck. But we're never seasick. Because we were up on the open deck, it was very cold, wearing great coats, and just looking and expecting to be attacked from the air. But it never happened. We sailed out in the Atlantic, and the next morning, relieved of guard duty, and I went down, and I never smelled such a miserable smell in all my life. They had boiled eggs for supper, and most of those boiled eggs were on the deck. That was absolutely horrible, the smell, and I went down lower decks. We went to where we'd been allocated our position, and because we were a headquarter company, we were fairly close. I think we were on around about on C deck, I think. The officers were up on B and A decks, and we were on, I think, C deck. But I once went to have a look down where the 8th Battalion were. There's someone right away down as far as it could possibly go. You could see the shape of the ship and just more or less floorboards on the bottom. And they had to sling hammocks to sleep. I found I couldn't sleep in a hammock. The first night I slung my hammock. The second night we were at sea. My back absolutely ached because the position of the hammock, you can't turn and you're just lying bent. So my mate, who I always associate myself with more than any other, Jimmy Sixsmith, and I decided that we would sleep on the hard floor, the deck. We spread our ground sheet on the deck with our hammock on top of it, and our blanket on the bottom, blanket on the top, and did our best to sleep like that. We were more or less like that until about 3 days out in the Atlantic. The Exeter was on our starboard, the Georgic was on the other side of the Exeter, and as far as we could see, in front and behind, there's at least 5 destroyers, there was 2 aircraft carriers. The aircraft carriers were all carrying fighters, either Spitfires or Hurricanes. They were all on the deck, open decks of these aircraft carriers. They must have been absolutely loaded. Around about the third day, we looked out, and all our escort carrier, escort convoy had just disappeared. The ships had opened out, the Exeter was still in its position, and flashing signals from their signals. Now, because we had been trained by a lamp, we were able to read some of the Morse code that was being signalled, but of course it was all sending code. We didn't have a copy of the code. But we used to practice reading their signal lamp, which were a lot, much bigger than our signal lamps, and they're much easier to read, but they were a little bit faster than what we've been trained to do.